Did you want to take a break?
Ready? Yep. And we're live.
Okay. We're recording?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, for the record then, I'd like to thank you very much for agreeing to participate in this interview and others in the future. And I'd like to remind you that what we're doing here today is part of a larger oral history project on the subject of leadership undertaken by the Randall L. Tobias Center for Leadership Excellence. And the goal is to create a body of source material that will help a variety of scholars and students and other users of these oral histories better understand leadership. So as I said to you before we turned the recorder on, I'd like to ask you for permission to record the interview, to transcribe the interview, and to place the recording and the transcription in the IUPUI archives and special collections for the use of the patrons of that facility.
You have my permission.
Okay, well thank you very much. I'm going to begin by asking you some very simple questions about your childhood and so on, and then we'll work on through your career for as much time as we have today. And the first question that I have, and because I want to get it in the record, is when and where were you born?
I was born in Indianapolis, Indiana, in the old Methodist Hospital right up the street, November 5th, 1935.
And what were your parents' names?
My mother's name was Mary Helen Massey, M-A-S-S-I-E, and my father's name was John Lowry, L-O-U-G-H-E-R-Y, Mutt.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
No.
So you were an only child?
I'm an only child.
Okay. Where did you go to elementary school?
Public school 84.
And where was that located?
57th and Central.
Now, I also understand that you attended Broad Ripple High School.
That's right. Now,
my son's also graduated from there. and I read the record that you played on the tennis team.
Yes, that's true.
Were you any good?
Well, I was the first man on the tennis team.
The first man.
Yeah. I was not a great tennis player. And when I went to Northwestern, I had no intention of even playing tennis for Northwestern. And my freshman year, this was during the era in which college athletes as freshmen could not participate in a varsity sport. That's changed now. And I won the intramural tennis tournament at Northwestern, and I beat a scholarship recipient who was a freshman.
Oh, my.
And so the coach called me and asked if I would come out for the tennis team, which I did. So I played tennis for Northwestern, too. I was number six man. That's as low as you get in it. But anyway, I played.
Well, you beat one of his scholarship recipients.
Yeah.
I also read in the record that you worked on the school paper at Broad Ripple and that you ran successfully for student council president.
Yes, I was the president of the student council for a couple of years. I was the managing editor of the Riparian, and that's the Broad Ripple High School weekly newspaper.
Did either working on the paper or running for student council have an impact on your career as it developed later on? Did you get the bug for journalism and politics in high school?
I don't think there's any question that my experience with paper and also the journalism courses, just a couple of them you took in high school, which required more of you as a writer than the typical high school writing work did. There was the advisor to the newspaper was a woman named Marie Griggs, G-R-I-G-G-S. And she had an enormous impact on me. First of all, she was a rigorous person in terms of the discipline that she employed in editing your work. And she, along with a great school teacher, who always said on my papers, "Johnny, you can do better." This Miss Coffing was her name, and she was at school 84. And paper after paper, she would write, "Johnny, you can do better." And I got a big kick out of this because I talked to her. She's still alive and lives in the teacher's retirement, or whatever the right name of it is, in Franklin, Indiana. She's well in her 90s, and I called her on her birthday, I reminded her of that, "Johnny, you can do better" line, and she said to me, "Well, Johnny, I think you've done okay." It was one of those great moments, but Yes, that certainly had an impact.
Do you think that the degree to which elementary school and high school nurtured your writing ability is something that still happens today in schools, public schools?
I'm not a good enough judge of exactly what takes place there. I do know that the test results we see would indicate to you that we're not doing as good a job as we need to do in terms of teaching writing. And of course, the advent of the computer and all that sort of thing changes the whole process. When I was writing this book, my co-author, Kathy Murray, who is my wife's nephew, or niece, I should say, I would write a chapter, she would send back comments on it, she would write some of the other chapters. And I kept saying to her, I said, Kathy, these aren't sentences. There's no subject and verb. I mean, they're not. And she said, oh, you don't worry about that anymore. That's not how we write anymore. And if you do read Dummy's books, you'll see that there are a number of what we used to call sentence fragments in it. And common usage is changing. I understand that. But nevertheless, the discipline of at that time period was a very important part of my life, I think.
I should probably say for the record that we don't accept sentence fragments now either, but just okay. For posterity.
Okay.
Would you describe yourself as a leader in high school?
Yes. I think I would have to say that in the areas in which I was involved, I was a leader. One of the things that my family's background and my father's influence and so forth is that, like thousands of Hoosier kids, I wanted to be a basketball player, say. And I made the freshman team at Broad Ripple, but was cut my sophomore year. And you would have thought somebody had cut my left arm off when this happened. I was so pained about it and hurt, all the rest of it. And one of the things I do remember, however, was that one of my teachers at school, 884, Dorothea Galley was her name. She's long since deceased. She said, take up tennis. She said this when we were in grade school, the seventh grade. She says, this is a sport you can play all your life. It'll be a lasting kind of physical thing you can do. And I guess that's kind of when I decided to concentrate on tennis after this happened, you know.
Do you think you had qualities as a high school student that made you stand out as a leader?
Well, the quality that I most exhibited early in high school was that of being a good student. And that cuts both ways. You know, on one side, that does give you some profile for leadership. On the other hand, there is a certain kind of stigma about being in today's terms, the nerd or the bookworm or whatever those kind of things are. And so I felt both of those influences, but I think that had something to do with it. I mean, when you recite in class and you know the answers and other people don't, that makes a difference. You know, it's that kind of thing.
And I note that you met your wife at Broad Ripple?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn Hawthorne?
Mm-hmm. We met in algebra class in our freshman year, and Carolyn was 2.5 inches taller than I was at that point, and she had matured as a woman, and I remember asking one of the other girls, well, how about this Carolyn Hawthorne? And the answer was, well, she only dates older guys. And she was dating a senior at Broad Ripple. And so my chance didn't come till the next year. And he graduated, obviously. And we were both initiated into the Honor Society as sophomores. And we walked home from the Honor Society meeting. That's how I was, our first date, if that's the true story. Yeah.
In what year did you get married?
We were married in 1957. I'm sorry, 1958. Graduated from college in first degree in 57, master's degree in 58. We got married, and we would have gotten married earlier, except that my parents said, we won't help you at all with your graduate education at Northwestern if you marry. That was, you know, the world's changed, obviously, but that was what happened. And so my wife-to-be taught in elementary school in suburban Chicago, lived in the near Chicago area, near Evanston, and I was getting my master's degree then.
One more question about growing up in Indianapolis. As you look back on growing up in Indianapolis, particularly your high school years, were there any individuals who played important roles in what later became your career trajectory? People who inspired you or influenced you?
Well, I've mentioned the advisor to the high school newspaper, Marie Griggs. I've mentioned Ms. Coffing, can't think of her first name right this minute, her influence on my work in a certain way. Those are good examples of people that really did make a difference. Obviously, my father played a major role in my growing up. I didn't know it at the time, but my mother was mentally ill a good deal of my childhood. And so my relationship with my mother is one that is a little difficult to characterize during this time period. She had severe cancer right after I was born, had a breast removed, and somehow or another she felt that the birth of the child was related to her cancer, which is, you know, probably not a logical conclusion, but it had an impact on my relationship with my mother. So that, you know, that's one of those things that makes a difference. Later on, it had a lot to do with my work in the mental health field as a legislator and a public official, still involved in some things there. But, you know, my father had an enormous impact on me during that time period.
Were there people who particularly had an influence in shaping your understanding or your practice of leadership?
That's a good question. Well, I'll give you one. Between the junior year and my senior year at Broad Ripple, I was selected to go to what's called the CHERUB program at Northwestern University. What this is a program in which the university invites to campus for, I believe it's 6 weeks now, outstanding high school students, in part because they'd like to recruit them to the institution. And they do this in journalism, theater, engineering, can't remember, there's four or five of them. But I went in the journalism program. Now, the deal is that you spend the morning taking college-level courses, writing courses and other things in journalism, and then the afternoon you have a chance to explore the greater Chicago area. They have facilitated discussions on current events. The year I went, the Republican National Convention was going on in Chicago. And I went down to the convention, to the floor, actually met Dwight Eisenhower, you know.
Oh my, the world has changed.
Yeah, you couldn't do that today. I mean, you wouldn't get near a candidate, but in that case.
You actually walked into the Republican National Convention as a high school student and met Dwight Eisenhower?
Well, I didn't meet him at the convention. Okay. I met him at the old Hilton Hotel, the Stevens it was called. But I stood in line. Yeah, there was this big long line waiting to shake his hand. So I just stood in line, walked in. The journalism school at Northwestern arranged for us to get on the floor of the convention. That was part of the deal, you know. But here's the story I want to tell you. There was a guy who was one of our counselors who had just graduated from the Bedell School of Journalism at Northwestern named Dick Stolle. Stolley, I believe. Dick was later to become the editor of Life, People, a whole bunch of publications in that firm's collection. Anyway, Dick was leading a discussion. We were sitting on the beach of Lake Michigan, middle of summertime, seven of us, or five of us, I don't know, something like that, in a circle, and we were talking about politics. And Dick asked the question, what do you think of politicians? Or as politics, as a career to pursue? And we talked around the circle, and most of the students said what I imagined they'd heard at home. Politicians weren't very honest, they're kind of slippery, and all that kind of stuff, you know. And so then he said, well, what kind of people ought to be in politics? And the litany was Lincolns and Washingtons and Jeffersons and things like this. And he said, well, you know, one of the things you ought to do is read the history of these individuals' lives, and you will find that they are human beings like all of you, and that they were subject to political ambition, to drive, to seeking power, to compromise. He said, that's one of the things that we tend to do is idealize these people and not realize that they were quite human. And so, you know, we listened and so forth. And this was before the day of really insightful histories of these people. I mean, we've got a lot of good stuff now on Adams and Washington and so forth, in which we're learning a lot of things about them. And Lincoln, too, for that matter. But anyway, then finally he said, what kind of people ought to be and so forth. And he said, well, you guys are the cream of the crop. That's why you're here at Northwestern. How about you? Well, why don't you run for office? And he finally said, well, would any of you consider it? And I raised my hand. And that I was the only one in the circle who did. Nobody else seemed to be very excited about that at the time. And I guess I have always known since then that I'd eventually get involved somewhere or another. Now, I didn't have, at that moment, an ambition to be governor or legislator or anything like that, but that is kind of one of those moments when you kind of tilt the idea a little bit, you know.
Did attending the Republican National Convention influence you along those lines?
Not so much, except in the sense that after it was over, of course, I told my mother about having met Dwight Eisenhower, and she couldn't believe it. You know, it was one of those things. Well, then, you may remember that election is the first election in which television commercials were used. And Eisenhower's commercials were a picture, where a man, was Eisenhower at a desk like this, and off camera they ask him questions. And of course, these were programmed questions, you know. And he'd say, well, I'm glad you asked, all this kind of stuff, you know. And then, and my mother said, isn't it wonderful the way he answers those questions? And of course, I said, Mom, that's all programmed. I mean, they script that out beforehand, you know, and so forth. She said, no, they don't. So, yes, the meeting him, being at the convention, seeing the hoopla, et cetera, followed by the kind of conversation. Now, my mother and father were insistent about dinner. I mean, I had to be at dinner every night at 6 o'clock or have one whale of a good excuse why I wasn't there. This was a command performance. And this lasted until the end of high school, basically. And our dinner table conversations had to be some of the most illuminating and informative kind of discussions that took place in my life. My father was an avid reader. I mean, he had two or three books going all at the same time, all the time. That was his recreation, among other things. He did other things, but that was his recreation. My mother was an avid reader. They both devoured books. And my mother was one of these members of the so-called women's book clubs. You've heard of these. And this is a case where one woman reads a book and reviews it for the rest, and then they discuss it and so forth. The influence of the two of them in that environment, and we talked about current events, we talked about Freud, we talked about the Kinsey Report when it came out. I was working on the copy desk of the Indianapolis News when the Kinsey Report was first released. And to tell you that was hot copy in those days is an understatement, because the teletype would run this stuff out, everybody would run over to read it, clip it off and so forth, you know. It was a whole new awakening in a variety of areas. And I remember my father talking about politics, and little did I know that I would be caught in one of these movements that he talked about. But he said, you know, one of the great things about the American political system is we have two parties, and the American public seems to have this desire periodically to clean house and put the other party in the so-called time for a change argument. And he said, I think that's one of the great things about our system. And I bought it at the time he told me that. But little did I know I'd become the victim of that particular approach when I ran for office. Now, I'm not suggesting I lost that election just because of that argument. There are a variety of things that were involved, and I was running against a very attractive candidate. But that is, you know, it's those kinds of discussions that took place. My dad was a businessman, CPA, and he went to Indiana University Business School, got an MBA at Harvard. I'm just giving you a little feel for the environment there.
Did you make friends during your high school years that stuck with you after you went to college and moved to Pittsburgh and came back to Indianapolis and began a career and a life here?
Clearly, I did. That's right. And some of those friendships endure to this very moment. Yeah.
Any of them that became entangled with your rise through the ranks as a leader?
Sure. Well, Frank Walker, I'd put on that list. Yeah, Frank Walker, who's the now emeritus, I guess, board chairman of Walker Information here in town. Frank and I were in high school together. Frank even chaired my campaign for student council president, just a senior class president, that's what it was. And he later became the treasurer of my campaign committee when I ran for lieutenant governor and governor. We've known each other since we were very little kids. I remember watching his mother do some of the early research that she did on the dining room table of their apartment on Compton Avenue across from Broad Ripple High School. I used to go over there and eat lunch once in a while. And Tommy Walker was there with her opinion studies at that point.
Yeah. Can you tell us about these? What were these opinion studies?
Well, I don't know what she was studying right then. I can't give you that. But her early work was in market research, and she tested nipples for baby bottles, anything you can imagine in the consumer product field.
Were there any events or experiences other than the Republican National Convention and going to Northwestern? Were there any events or experiences that shaped your experience or your practice of leadership as you were growing up?
Well, yeah, I think so. Let me give you an example. One of them was my father came home one day when I was still in grade school. He was vice president of the Barbasol Shaving Cream Company, which was headquartered here in Indianapolis at that time, and chief financial officer. And he said, I had an unusual experience today. He said, I spent a good part of the day reviewing United Way funding applications. I'd never even heard of the United Way. I didn't know what it was or anything. And so he spent that dinner table describing what he'd done. Now, back in those days, Jerry, volunteers did a whole lot of sifting through fundraising applications from the groups and so forth. It's been a long time ago. But at any rate, he described to me this, and I said, well, you know, why are you doing it? And he said, well, we think it's good business to care about the community where we're doing business. And he said, there are people in this community who need lots of help. And he said, this is one of the things that you have to do that. Later on, I'd never dreamed I'd end up someday being the chair of the campaign, as Jerry has been, and so forth. but my dad's comment essentially was that there is a common good out here that has to be served at some point. He never used that term. That's a Bob Payton term, but he never used that term. So you asked, does that have an impact on leadership? I think it does, because I think it broadens your perspective. I mean, I really think that's important. Another thing that I remember about my dad during that time period was he said, "Son, you want to go downtown with me today? I'm going to go see," and I can't think of the man's name, but he was an African-American maintenance man at the barbershop company. And his wife had died, and he had a family crisis of some kind. And so my dad went down to offer him money and some help. And my dad's comment was, there's some people in society that you just kind of have to, if they come across your life, you have to stop and help them sometimes. That was kind of his line. And that's, I've never forgotten that. I mean, it's one of those things you can't forget. He never, gave me a lecture on this subject or anything like that. It was by example. And when we get down to talking about the specifics of my leadership philosophy, if you want to talk about that.
I certainly do.
That's one of the things that I think is involved, and that's modeling behavior by what you do rather than by what you say. And I, that's a trite statement, but I think it's true.
How do you think that you've done that in your career? Modeling behavior by what you do.
Well, I'll take a very simple example. When I went to work for the Lilly Endowment, I told you earlier this was an authoritarian kind of situation. Well, among the authoritarian perks was that there was an assigned parking place for every single person at Lilly Endowment. And the chairman's little spot was the closest to the door, and the president next closest, and all this kind of stuff. And when we decided to redo the parking lot, I said, this doesn't make any sense to me. I think it's first come, first serve. Whoever gets here first can park closer to the door, as far as I'm concerned. And I gave up my parking space. Now, that's a very small little thought, but this sent a message, a different kind of message. I guess that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. another one was I was at Lilly Endowment, and we had installed our intranet, I guess you'd call it. And this is, several levels of sophistication lower than where the world is today with PCs and everything. But at any rate, one of the things that happened was one of my PhDs, and I had a lot of PhDs that worked there, came in one day, and she was a person who never hesitated to tell you what she thought about most everything. And she walked in and she says, "John, I've had enough." She said, "If you don't answer your emails, nobody else in this place is going to." And, that was the point. I started religiously every morning. That was the first thing I did when I got there, was to answer the emails from the rest of the staff. Even if it was just, "I'll talk to you about this later," whatever it was, he had to get back to him. Clearly, the staff was never going to use that system unless I used it. I mean, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. They're small little items often,
I wrote down a phrase that you used a minute ago, and I think this relates to philosophy of leadership, so I think I'll just follow up and ask you that now. You mentioned you're paraphrasing something your father said. You said, yeah, the common good has to be served. How do you figure out what the common good is?
Boy, that's a tough question. Most of our society's views of the common good, I think, came originally from the religious background that is part of our society. And there is not a single major religion that doesn't include in it the idea of charity, helping the poor and all that sort of thing. So you can take your admonitions conceivably from that start. Now, one of the problems you get into here is in America, like everything else we've done in our society, we've elevated philanthropy to almost a science, or at least an art form. Excuse me. And what we've done, of course, is we now engage in what some people call scientific philanthropy, you know, where it's all done on the basis of research, and then we come back and try it out and test it and all that sort of thing. We also are in a situation now, it seems to me, in that field, in which the question of do no harm suddenly has to be on your agenda. Because you can be so aggressively interested in changing the world that you do something that inadvertently has a number of side effects that are maybe worse than what you wanted to solve in the first place. So I have a lot of difficulty answering your question directly. You know, how do you know? Your conscience tells you. Your religious background tells you. those are things that are involved in that.
I mean, I think that is one of the issues that public servants and philanthropists wrestle with, is what is the common good?
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned religious background. Has your religious background had an influence on who you've become as a leader?
Well, see, that's going to be an interesting story, because I was not brought up in a religious home. My parents didn't go to church. They took me to Sunday school when I was very young, and I didn't like it, and so they didn't insist that I go back. I was not baptized until I was 35 years old. But the philosophy that we're talking about here was clearly apparent in the actions and in the things that my mother and father talked about. So, you know, you ask, did religion play a role? In the early part of my life, no. Mm-hmm. At least organized religion. Did it after my mid-30s? Yes, mm-hmm. There's no question about that it did. Now, I'm not a born-again Christian in the sense of our religious rite. Mm-hmm. When I was in politics, I had a lot of people ask me if I was. And that's a tough question to answer in that environment. but I guess I'd have to say to you that my involvement in a church experiment here in Indianapolis called the Church of the Savior, which is patterned after the Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C., did have an enormous impact on this sort of thing. And this was a church that required for membership to take a course, a 10-week course, in practical Christianity. That was the way it was described. And this was a series of case studies. You know, for example, one case study was the church treasurer is caught stealing money. What is the obligation of the church in this respect? Do you turn him into the authorities, prosecute him? Do you forgive him? I mean, that was the discussion that we had. We read several books of the New Testament and one book of the Old Testament in this course as well. that probably started me off on a new course in terms of my religious background. Like a lot of college kids, we talked a lot about philosophy and religion at Northwestern. Did not regularly attend church at Northwestern. No. So I have to be one of those people that came out of an unchurched background.
The Church of the Savior was, you attended while you were at Northwestern?
No, that's here in Indianapolis after I got married.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a Methodist church. Thank you, that's great.
I'm going to ask you one more question, and then I'll give Jerry and mm-hmm. Gerald Bepko and John Beeler a chance to ask, and then maybe we'll hit the pause button and give you a chance to take a drink and
okay.
catch your breath. I can't resist asking you, occurs to me, if I can add correctly, that you were a teenager during some of the hottest years of the Cold War. Did that national, international context have any influence on who you became as a leader or a politician? Or?
Our discussions around the dinner table were largely about the question or not of whether or not having two major powers in the world was a deterrent to war. I mean, this was the kind of debate that my father would raise. And you know, the attitude being that, you remember the nuclear buildup was built on the premise, I think the U.S.'s argument for that was, as long as we're strong and they're strong, we're not going to be so stupid as to launch a nuclear warhead or an atomic warhead. And so we did have what I would describe as a dinner table conversation about that. Now, when I was a very young child, one of my distant cousins was a World War II hero. He was a fighter pilot, shot down a whole bunch of enemy planes. He was shot down once himself. I remember that this Indianapolis papers had stories about him. He was a hero in every sense of the word, at least as we defined it in those days. And we talked about him. But you see, I'm one of those people who, even though we had a major conflict in the Second World War and those military engagements that followed, seldom, I never had a direct contact with somebody who was physically killed or badly maimed in those situations. My father was 4F and didn't go to the armed forces. And I didn't serve in the armed forces either. So, you know, that was a little distant from my early childhood and high school years, you know.
Jerry, do you want to ask anything?
No, I think you've covered it very well.
John?
I have one question. It seems like the early inception of your leadership style is closely tied to morality, or maybe a better word would be ethics. Like, when thinking about experiences that shaped your leadership, they're largely ethical with your father, or at least they seem to be. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is too forward-looking, but how has that early ethical aspect of leadership affected your leadership in business? How does that translate over to business, which in many ways is, when you just kind of think about it, it's just cold, hard money. It's not inherently ethical as we understand it. Or perhaps you would think differently than it actually is. And that would be just yeah. Interesting.
Well, you have to start with two premises when you think about that. One is, at least to date, my view of the world is that capitalism is the best way to distribute resources within our society, subject to the interaction of government on behalf and the nonprofit sector on behalf of the very needy and those at the bottom of the pyramid, so to speak. So you have to, I think, first of all, premise your views of some of these things on whether or not you really believe capitalism is the best way to allocate resources. And then I think from that, then you have to say, if that's true, then how do you manage a capitalistic enterprise in a way that meets both of these goals? One, the maximization of profit, and second, your community responsibilities. I don't think you can leave the second one out. And so that's where I come from on that.
Does it work well? Does it fit when you're operating ethically through business? As opposed to, I suppose, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that it seems like you've spent much of your life in civic or nonprofit work. And so when you moved over to business, do you find that there are obstacles, or do you find that it's easier or not, or no change at all, to be ethical or to lead ethically?
I think the temptations are present in all three of these endeavors: philanthropy, for-profit business, and government. I mean, the temptations to do the wrong thing are always present.
And it's just as easy in each sector to help people?
Yes, I think it is. I would agree with that. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that you've been successful as a businessman in both maximizing profit and exercising community responsibility as a leader?
That's a that's a judgment other people probably ought to make. But yes, I think I've been successful at that.
Give an example?
Yeah.
Maybe there's another question in here. Interesting to hear your reactions about looking at the different sectors that you've been in, and then taking this spectrum of ideas with the most noble purposes on the one hand, and the most self-serving or venal purposes on the other, which can exist in nonprofit or government or business.
All three of them.
In the case of a business person, someone could say, my desire in life is to create the best kind of service to my community, and incidentally, I will be rewarded for it. Over to, on the other hand, any way I can make money on this, I'll do it. It isn't my goal to satisfy, it's my goal only to maximize my return. How would you place the people you've met in these three sectors along those spectrums, from self-interest, complete self-interest, over to public service? And is there a difference between business and government?
Well, of course, there's a difference between all three of these. But the human personalities in the three all have the same frailties, and also have some of the visionary ideas about what the ideal ought to be. I mean, you find them all in all three sectors. I often get asked the question, well, how about these three sectors, because you've had a leadership position in all three of them. And this is maybe a little aside from your point, but I found politics to be the most challenging of the three. It required more of my heart and soul. It's almost a 16 an hour a day kind of endeavor. I found the endowment to be the most intellectually stimulating place I had ever been. And I can give you all kinds of examples of that. the for-profit sector, I found to be the one with the most difficult management challenges. And of course, it depends on which business experience you're talking about. See, I had some business experience early in my life when I left Alcoa and came back to Indianapolis. And I had a home building business, and I was involved with an equipment leasing company and so forth. Those were very challenging kinds of situations, you know. I mean, in the case of the home building business, survival. I mean, I lost a lot of money. And it's kind of an amazing story there. We lost a lot of money in a two-year period of time. And so we got out of that business. And the financial backers who had helped me stayed with me for a little period of time. And I bought a fast food franchise, Burger Chef. And I mean, it's a long story, but the point I'd make is we earned all the money back in the fast food business in about a year and a half that we lost in 2.5 years in the home building business. And we had a loss carry forward. Back in those days, in the business world, if you had a loss in a corporation, it stayed with the corporate shell. In other words, you could put a new business venture in it and still get the benefit of the shelter. So you had sheltered that new income without paying taxes on it. Today, you can't do that. It has to be the same or a similar business. It's a different law. But anyway, back then, it worked very nicely for me. And so, you know, I'm mentioning these as the challenges. You're on the ethical questions. And as I said, I found the lack of ethics or the existence of people with a very strong commitment to doing the right thing in all three of these situations. I mean, I didn't find any. I mean, the human beings, it seems to me, are always present there. Does that answer this?
It does.
That's, that's what I was thinking of, is if you look at the spectrum from nobility to venality, you'll find people in each of these sectors that are somewhere in that spectrum. Mm-hmm. And you say they're spread about the same way.
Yeah, I think they're spread about the same way. Yeah.
Why did you find politics to be the most challenging of the three endeavors that you've been involved in?
Well, I don't know exactly. It's just the way I practiced it, I suppose. But in part, well, I have to take you back to a little history here. When I was in grade school, I had a substantial speech impediment. You may even notice it today, but I'm a stutterer. And I stuttered so much when I was in like the third and fourth grade that it was an effort for me to recite in class. It was really tough. And it was even hard to go to a movie theater and ask for a ticket. And talking on the phone was difficult, that sort of thing. They brought a speech therapist in back in those days to work with me and so forth. And when I first ran for the legislature in 1964, anybody who heard me speak would tell you that I was a mess. My wife would tell you that if you were to interview her. She said, "I don't see why you were willing to do this in front of people and allow people to laugh at you and so forth," which happens sometimes. I guess I must have been pretty highly motivated to do this, you know. But what happened over the years was that either through luck or just experimentation, I managed to control it and deal with it. And there is a breathing technique that I still use that now I hear experts talk about as one of the ways that you deal with stuttering. But, I mean, I remember my grade school situation. It was pretty painful from time to time because of this. And my wife, of course, thinks I'm nuts to be a politician generally. I mean, that's never been her preference for a career. even though her mother was one of the first women to serve in the legislature and held, she was Marion County Recorder and a bunch of stuff like that. The other thing about this is the schedule that you lead, you're kind of always on, if you want to call it that. And I also found it a real challenge to master the details of the issues that were involved. But that's the part I like the most. I'm a wonk at heart, you know, rather than a, you know, I always ask, I look at politicians and I ask myself, what kind of guy is this? What kind of woman is this? What turns them on in this process? Now, Bill Hudnut, for example. Bill loved the crowd. He loved shaking hands. He loved kidding people. He loved hugging people. I mean, that was all part of his life. He loved it. Dick Lugar, on the other hand, detests that part of politics. And taking Dick to a cocktail party is something he just doesn't like doing. But he knows you got to do that if you're going to get elected. So he's taught himself how to deal with it and to endure it is the right word. And the thing I always tell about Dick Lugar was that, you know what the Indiana Society of Chicago is? You guys know what that is?
I've heard of it.
Okay, well, this is a huge party held in Chicago, started years ago by a bunch of Hoosiers who were well-known and quite learned and important people in the past. And it's just a huge party. Goes on for 3 days, essentially, or Friday night to Sunday. And Dick Lugar went once. I was with him. In fact, we were roommates. Keith Bulin took us. And Dick never said this, but he never went back again. Now, for some politicians, they'd say, you got to go. This is a place where every politician in Indiana goes. Dick conveniently has arranged this run for the cure, or whatever it is he has out of Butler University, on that same weekend. And so he's got a good excuse why he's never there. So I'm just contrasting how people practice politics. People are brought to it for different reasons. And I guess in my case, it was understanding the policy issue, figuring out solutions, convincing other people that there's a way to do this, et cetera. That's what it was fun for me and absorbing for me. And so, you know, I rewrote the school formula in Indiana twice when I was in the legislature. And the school formula is one of those arcane things that, well, Roger Brannigan used to say, I think there are five people in Indiana understand it now, so it's time to change it again.
Oh, my.
This was, Roger was the governor of Indiana when I first was in the legislature. So you know, it's a different kind of thing. And I find that in a most absorbing kind of thing. I don't have a really good answer to your question. But.
Why don't we use the pause button? Give everybody a chance to get it. What I would like to do is, I'm going to ask you a little bit about Northwestern, and then I think that we mentioned to you when we had lunch with you that we have some common questions on leadership,
yeah.
And I'm going to salt several of those in, and I think at that point,
okay.
What I'm going to do is have you to a point where you're moving back to Indianapolis,
all right.
And that will give John and I a chance to digest what you told us at the beginning.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Are we on?
We're on.
Okay. So, we just recorded everything I told him.
Yeah.
Oh my, there are no secrets. Okay. All right. You earned a bachelor's and master's degree from Northwestern University in 1957 and 1958, respectively. And the first question that I was going to ask you is why Northwestern, but I think you kind of answered that for us.
I did. I think the chair of experience sold me on Northwestern. I came from a family in which both my mother and father went to Indiana, and during my young years, there were many weekends we spent on the campus, and we went to football games. And you know, there was no doubt that John Mutz was going to go to college. That was an understanding. My parents never said you have to go, you have to have good grades, all those kind of things. But by their example, and I remember my mother so often talking about how lucky she was to have gotten to college. She was from a farm family living south of Columbus, Indiana, first in her family ever to attend college. In fact, her mother never went to high school even, nor did her father.
And she was an IU graduate?
No, she didn't graduate. Mm-hmm. She was there, I think, for 3 years. At that time in history, you could get a teacher's license without the full degree by taking a qualifying test. That's what she did, and then she taught school. But anyway, the point I'm getting at is that college educations were a cherished commodity in our household.
What was your undergraduate major at Northwestern?
Well, in the School of Journalism at Northwestern, you have fields of concentration, and mine were psychology and political science. Mm-hmm. So I have kind of like a major in those two fields, but they're within the school.
Within the School of Journalism.
Yeah.
What was the focus of your master's degree?
Well, the master's degree is a program that's no longer offered at Northwestern. I have an MS, not an MBA, but it was taught in connection with the business school at Northwestern. So I have what approximates an MBA in those days, and I was trained technically to be a publisher of a newspaper. I know that sounds wild, and certainly highly specialized. Obviously, I never did that. But it included case studies of newspapers in which you actually went and spent 3 or 4 weeks in a newspaper and spent time with management and learned each of the pieces of the business, the advertising, the editorial costs and all that kind of thing. It was in the advertising sequence at Northwestern, but the program I was involved in actually would train you to be a publisher of a newspaper.
Although you certainly, it appears as though you drew on some of that learning later on.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I've often said if I had to do it over again, I would have done something differently. I never have regretted my undergraduate years at Northwestern. They were absolutely the most eye-opening, mind-bending years of my life, I think. I mean, I was a green kid from Indianapolis, and I was exposed to things I didn't know existed and ideas that I didn't know existed. It was just remarkably exciting. My master's degree year, however, was kind of like more of the same. And if I had to do it over again, I would have gone to law school, I think. But I didn't think in those terms at that point.
Could you talk a little bit more about why you found your undergraduate experience at Northwestern eye-opening and mind-bending?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, to start with, this is a liberal campus. And the number one rule at Northwestern in those days, and still may be true today, and that is we don't care whether you go to class. We don't care whether you ever go to the library. This is all up to you. The resources are here. Now, you can spend your time going to the local bar or at the coffee shop or whatever it is and all those kind of things, but the resources are remarkable that are there. Great library, extremely good professors in most of the areas. And so I guess the mind-bending part of the thing was, you know, finding, did I have the discipline within myself, first of all, to do that? And I found that I did. That is a, you know, at Broderipal High School, you're kind of led around. You know, it's that kind of a situation. And suddenly you are on your own. And that was an eye-opening experience. Secondly, my experience with individuals from other religions and races was dramatically changed in Northwestern. I mean, it's the first time I had ever really had a conversation with an African American about anything of substance. Remember one of my classmates named Troy Duster, who is now a professor, University of California, I think. He's the first Black American that I really talked to in any depth about relationships among the races, and how he felt about his own role and all that sort of thing. First time I ever really talked to a Jewish woman, seriously. And there was a young Jewish woman who I had several dates with. And I found her to be extremely attractive, and we had obviously some interest in each other. And she finally said one day, "We know this can't be." She said, "My parents could never accept you." And I mean, that was I had never experienced those sorts of situations before. It's the first time in my life that I had ever really understood symphonies. There was a professor on campus who on Saturdays took a bunch of us down to the Chicago Symphony. And back in those days, you could buy a symphony ticket for 50 cents. You had to sit in the very, very top balcony, but made no difference. The music was as good there as it was anywhere else. And then on the way home, he would describe to us what we had just heard. He was a student of most of these composers, and he'd talk about the soloists and why they were good and why they weren't. And I mean, again, you know, that's one of those, it's informal education. It's not in any class, but it was something very, very special. And then I was involved in student government at Northwestern. And I was, for the first time in my life, really forced to think through an issue, provide an argument for it, and in many cases, in opposition to someone else in the situation. one of the examples of that was a big discussion on Northwestern campus. See, this was before the era of the student revolution. I was that quiet generation, just the tail end of the quiet generation. And for example, I mean, a big deal at Northwestern those days was a panty raid. And we had panty raids. In fact, our panty raids were so significant, they made Time magazine and Life magazine and so forth. That's hardly a student revolt of any magnitude, but particularly when the women came out and threw them out to the people participating. But anyway, that's aside the point. The big discussion on campus at that point was the existence of discriminatory institutions on campus, fraternities and sororities. And the argument was that Northwestern should outlaw any organization on campus that discriminates on that basis.
On the basis of race or religion?
Race or religion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's okay to discriminate on the basis of accomplishment. That was another issue, too. But we talked about that. And so the student government at Northwestern, of which I was an elected representative nearly all my time in office, I mean, all the time in school, I lost the election for student body president at Northwestern, but I was involved in student government all the time I was there. There was this debate going on about, you know, should the SGB, the student government board, adopt a resolution that asked the administration to outlaw discriminatory organizations. And so we suddenly got into the debate about this question. And I was a beta at Northwestern, Beta Theta Pi. And Beta Theta Pi at that time had a discriminatory clause in its national constitution. And one of the arguments that the betas made on this subject was that while it wouldn't be a big problem at Northwestern to have people with differing backgrounds, the southern chapters would absolutely be unable to recruit new pledges and all the rest of it, you know. So, and of course, there was a counter argument, and that was, well, if you eliminate the campus organizations that discriminate, then you eliminate that voice at the national level for change. So I made a pledge that I would go to the Beta Convention in Miami, at Miami University in Ohio, where it happened to be held, and argue for the elimination of our discriminatory clause. Well, I wasn't listened to any great extent, that this was not a popular idea at that moment. But, you know, these are eye-opening times when you have been as cloistered as I was as a kid. The only black people I had known really were the maintenance man at the barbershop company I mentioned and the cleaning lady who came and cleaned our house once a week, you know. So it's one of those kind of eye-opening things. The other eye-openers had to do with the professors themselves. I mean, these men and women were really stimulating people, and they forced you to debate things and question and so forth. But those are just samples I've given you there. You know. I could think of some others, I think.
I think that we probably are going to need to let you go to your lunch in a
while. Okay.
What I would like to do next time is to pick up with some of those questions that we gave you ahead of time, mm-hmm. like general questions on leadership, what do you read, what do you think a leader should read, and so on.
Yeah.
Probably the first four or five. And then we're going to pretty quickly get to your business experience in Indianapolis and your electoral career here in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. So thank you very, very much for sitting with us.
Well, this is fun. I've enjoyed doing it. Let me ask you, I have two quick questions. Now, are the things that we are cov-